So Far From Home, The Diary of Mary Driscoll, An Irish Mill Girl, by Barry Denenberg, pages 141 to 142. Epilogue. Nora Kinsella, Mary's aunt, continued to teach school in Lowell for 32 more years. Kate Driscoll worked for Mrs. Abbott until 1851, when she met and married Dennis Kelly. They had two children. Sean Riordan fled Boston as soon as Mary provided the necessary bail money. His whereabouts after 1847 are unknown. Annie Clark left the mills in 1848 as planned. She traveled west, stopping in Racine, Wisconsin. There she married Silas Marks, one of the town's leading lawyers. She and her husband had no children. Patrick Quinn's tavern grew in size, doubling as a grocery store by day. He became a wealthy man of property, although he never ran for elective office. He was so influential in Boston politics that it was said, "You can't win without Quinn." He was loved and respected throughout the Boston Irish community. Laura Austin and Mary Driscoll, with Quinn's help, placed Alice O'Donnell in the capable hands of the Perkins Institute for the Blind. There, Alice learned the manual alphabet and other ways of improving her communication with the outside world. She was well cared for. Mary Driscoll died in cholera epidemic of 1849. She was 17. So Far From Home, The Diary of Mary Driscoll, An Irish Mill Girl, by Barry Denenberg. Pages 143 to 164. Life in America in 1847. Historical note. Beginning in 1845, Ireland experienced an extended crop failure that became known as the Great Famine. Over the next 5 years, 1 million of Ireland's 9 million citizens died, and almost 2 million immigrated to other countries. The Great Famine was the result of two terrible forces. First, potatoes, the basic crop of Irish tenant farmers, were attacked by a blight or fungus. Because the Irish farmers were unable to plant new healthy potato crops, their primary diet there was widespread starvation. Second, Ireland, subject to British rule since the beginning of the 19th century, consisted of large estates owned and managed by English landlords. These estates were divided into small farms, rented at high rates to poor Irish farmers. When half the oat crop failed, farmers were unable to pay their rents, and many landlords evicted them. Initially, there was little help from the British government. Their laziness fair, or hands-off approach, allowed the large landowners to run their own affairs. As starvation and evictions worsened, the British Prime Minister, Sir Robert Peel, set up public works programs. Irishmen were hired as laborers or make-work construction projects such as famine roads, which were created more to keep the men busy than to build functioning roads. The wages were very low, not nearly enough to prevent starvation or evictions. What Ireland needed was food and a new farming system. By 1847, conditions in Ireland had reached catastrophic levels. Many people were reduced to eating seaweed and cabbage leaves, even grass and tree bark. Women with no children often left their husbands to move into poorhouses or workhouses for the homeless. Diseases such as typhus, relapsing fever, and drowsy were rampant, bringing death. Public works programs were stopped, and soup kitchens were set up to feed the starving. Each person was allowed to receive 2 meals of free soup a week. Help came from churches and governments around the world, and the United States Congress authorized millions of dollars for famine relief. These efforts eventually ended the Great Famine, but for many it was too little too late. The town of Skibbereen in County Cork was the hardest hit in all of Ireland, and the area was known as the Fatal District. So many people died that there weren't enough coffins in which to bury the dead. For the people of Skibbereen and many other parts of Ireland, the only choice was to leave their country. By the early 1850s, approximately one quarter of Ireland's population had left. The British government encouraged immigration of the Irish to other countries as the solution to their troublesome problem. Ticket prices for ship for ship passage were kept low. In some cases, English landlords purchased tickets for their tenant farmers, grateful to get rid of them. For most immigrants, however, tickets were bought with money raised by selling their few remaining belongings or with money sent to them by relatives in other countries. A popular saying was, "The only place in Ireland a man can make his fortune is in America." The voyage to America took at least 6 weeks, and sometimes more than 3 months. The cheapest passage was in old wooden slave ships called coffin ships, or in steerage on sailing sloops. Passengers were crowded into tiny closed living quarters with little ventilation. Food and water on these ships were scarce. Water was stored in barrels that had formerly carried products like vinegar and turpentine, making it unfit for drinking. On long voyages, meat became tainted, and bread and flour crawled with insects and vermin. Cattle and pigs were treated better than the passengers. Fire was a constant danger, and cooking and smoking were extremely risky. There were few facilities for washing, and because the steerage was so filthy, diseases spread rapidly. In 1847, the worst year of the Great Famine, 7,000 immigrants perished aboard ships, and another 10,000 died from landing in America. After landing in America. Upon arriving in the United States, immigrants underwent a medical examination. Those who were sick and did not pass the examination were either placed in quarantine until they were well or turned away. Those turned away frequently sailed on to Canada. In the large port cities of Philadelphia, New York, and Boston, the new immigrants with high hopes, little money, and few skills were easily victimized. Their Catholic religion was feared and often scorned, and they faced harsh discrimination and prejudice. When seeking work, they were often rejected by NINA signs, which meant no Irish need apply. In the 1820s, the industrial revolution began in Lowell, Massachusetts, at the Pawtucket Falls on the Merrimack River. It was a factory in the wilderness, started by young, adventuresome investors from well-to-do Boston families. They brought together a new system of textile manufacturing using power looms, a primarily female workforce, and venture capital in order to make money. They were extraordinarily successful. By 1847, Lowell, a city of 3,000 people, was the center for textile manufacturing in the United States. The Lowell textile mills employed 15,000 workers, two-thirds of whom were young women. Between the ages of 15 and 30, from New England, work in the mills was hard, but provided young women with one of the few chances to earn cash wages. To recruit young women to work in the textile mills, the corporations built large, well-run brick boarding houses. They encouraged the establishment of churches and sponsored schools, libraries, hospitals, health clinics, charitable organizations, reading rooms, and lectures. The lectures included popular writers, educators, and activists such as Ralph Waldo Emerson. In the evenings and on weekends, improvement circles were held in churches and reading rooms, and young men were encouraged to write poetry and short stories. These young female workers had a strong sense of independence. They fought for better working conditions, a 10-hour workday, and higher wages. Although not always successful, they used petitions, legislative hearings, walkouts, newspaper editorials, and journal articles to fight for their rights. They published a pro-labor newspaper, The Voice of Industry, and a literary magazine, The Lowell Offering. When the textile corporations entered upon a major expansion program, they needed additional workers to meet their ambitious plans. The enormous numbers of unskilled famine Irish immigrants who were pouring into America, desperate for jobs, became the new source. The Lowell factory system began to change in the 1850s. New advanced technology enabled less skilled workers to produce more cloth at lower wages. The directors of the corporations were more interested in profit than in the workers' welfare. Life in the mills became less desirable for the Yankee girls, and mill management shifted recruiting efforts toward immigrants. The poor, uneducated, and unskilled famine Irish had little choice but to endure these hardships in order to survive in their new homeland. From the founding of Lowell, small numbers of Irish immigrants had come to help construct the power canals and brick mills and boarding houses. They had established two Catholic churches, opened shops and businesses, and attended city Irish schools taught by Irish women and men. In some ways, these early Irish immigrants paved the way for the famine Irish who followed. Thousands of Irish immigrants flowed into the United States, surviving and overcoming terrible conditions. Unskilled jobs with low wages required entire families, mothers, fathers, and older children, to work in order to earn a living wage. Discrimination forced families to live in deplorable housing in overcrowded neighborhoods. Religious prejudice and language. Many Irish immigrants spoke the Irish language, often isolated and segregated the Irish community. But ultimately, with citizenship and the vote, the Irish gained the opportunity to participate as equals in the American system. Still, even 150 years later, it would be hard to find people of Irish extraction who don't remember the famine and many hardships their ancestors endured on the way to becoming full-fledged American citizens. The picture above shows some people working, and it says, "The potato, a cheap but nutritious food, was the principal diet of the poor in Ireland until 1845, when a fungus destroyed most of the crop. The failure of the potato crop was the cause of the Great Famine, in which almost 1 million Irish people starved to death." The next picture shows some people on a ship, and it says, "Desperate for basic survival, nearly 2 million Irish fled their homeland, and half of them came to America. Passage cost little, but the wooden ships were terribly uncomfortable, grossly unsanitary, and easily caught fire. Tens of thousands died at sea." The next picture has a picture of what looks like some factories, and it says, "Lowell, Massachusetts was the center of textile manufacturing in the 1840s. As workers in the mill, young single women were taught skills of the trade as well as reading and writing." And the picture below it is a picture of the inside of the mills. And it says, "One of the most important inventions of the Industrial Revolution was the power loom, which enabled one person to supervise several mechanized looms at once. With fewer workers, textile mills were unable to churn out bolts of fabric more quickly." This had an obvious result, profit. The next picture is a picture of the Voice of Industry. And by it, it says, "Mill owners motivated by profit and greed showed little concern for their workers' welfare. Labor newspapers, such as the Voice of Industry, provided workers with a forum for speaking out against inhumane working conditions." The picture below looks like women working the looms. The mill girls wore simple dresses. They kept their long hair pinned up in order to avoid the dangerous possibility of getting it caught in the machines. The next picture is another woman working a loom. There's hierarchy of workers in the mill, according to their skills, from the lowest bobbin girl who replaced the empty spools to the weavers whose skill and practiced eye created the patterns of fabrics. In between, there were spinners who spun yarn and drawing in girls who threaded yarn for the weavers. The picture below looks like an ad for the Merrimack Manufacturing Company. And below it, it says, "Merrimack was one of the many internationally known manufacturers of textiles in Lowell, Massachusetts during the period of time. Cloth fabrics from Lowell were sold and shipped to all parts of the world from nearby ports." And the next picture is a timetable of the Lowell Mills. And below it, it says, a worker's life was strictly regulated by the clock. Bells were rung to designate each change of activity, and workers were fined for their lateness. The next picture, I don't really know what it is, but it says Lowell Offering. Below it, it says, this popular magazine was written by and for female mill workers. It became an outlet for creative expression and featured poetry, short stories, essays, announcements of cultural activities, and advertisements. The next picture looks like it is of a street, and below it says the town of Lowell was the hub of social activity and a cultural center. The mill girls enjoyed a certain independence and could use their wages as they pleased. They went downtown to buy clothes and books, to attend theater concerts and poetry readings, and to have tea after church. The picture below is of St. Patrick's Church. And beside it, it says St. Patrick's Church became the center of the Irish immigrant social world as well as their religious sanctuary. And the next picture is of a boarding house, and below it says, mill agents provided clean, supervised, pleasant boarding houses where the mill girls ate together, shared rooms, and had curfews, almost as if they were living in college sororities. The picture below it is a picture of a neighborhood, and below it says, the famine Irish lived mainly in impoverished neighborhoods like the acre shown here. Though the photos on this page were not taken until the 1930s, the buildings remain much the same as they were in 1847. The next picture is some sheet music for the song Hear the Wind Blow, and below it says, music has always been an important part of Irish culture, and many popular American folk songs have their roots in Ireland. This is one of the many songs the Irish brought to the United States, and it was sung wherever they settled, from Massachusetts to California. The next picture is Hear the Wind Blow Continued. And then the next picture is a modern map of the continental United States. And below it says, modern map of the continental United States showing the approximate location of Lowell, Massachusetts. And below it is a map. And below the map, it says, this map shows the main streets of Lowell as they were in 1847.